This is The Reason Podcast, and I'm your host, Nick Gillespie. One of the leading candidates for the Democratic nomination for president in 2020 is Senator Elizabeth Warren from Massachusetts. She's been a law professor at University of Pennsylvania and Harvard, among other places, for years, and she began honing a critique decades ago of capitalism that would lead to her role in creating, among other things, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, an Obama-era agency that many expected her to head up. However, because of pushback by Republicans, she ultimately returned to Harvard and then later ran successfully for Senate, winning a seat in 2012. Warren was a registered Republican from 1991 to 96, telling journalist George Packer, "I was a Republican because I thought those were the people who best supported markets. Last July, she said, I'm a capitalist. Come on, I believe in markets." And she continued to say, "What I don't believe in is theft. What I don't believe in is cheating. That's where the difference is. I love what markets can do. I love what function economies can do," she said. "They are what make us rich. They are what create opportunity, but only fair markets, markets with rules. Markets without rules is about the rich taking it all. It's about the powerful getting all of it. And that's what's gone wrong in America." So, while the 69-year-old Oklahoman is unlikely to win the Democratic nomination, Elizabeth Warren's platform is very likely to be incorporated in part or whole into the Democratic platform and whatever set of issues the Democratic candidate's going to be running on. She's called for a wealth tax of 2% on households who have more than $50 million in assets and 3% on assets over $1 billion. She's proposed the Accountable Capitalism Act, which would mandate that corporations with $1 billion a year in revenue get a national charter rather than the current state charters they have, that would mandate workers vote for 40% of board seats, and that 75% of shareholders and board members approve any political spending. Last week, she unveiled a plan to break up tech companies such as Facebook, Amazon, Apple, Netflix, and Google, the so-called FANG companies or tech giants. The law, according to The Verge website, which interviewed her, would regulate any company that runs an online marketplace and makes more than $25 billion a year as a platform utility. Her plan would prohibit those companies from using those platforms from selling their own products. Amazon wouldn't be able to sell Amazon Basics. Google couldn't advertise its own products in its search engines. And Apple would either simply run its app store or give it up so it can sell its own products and services through somebody else's app store. These are big and bold ideas. There's no question about it. And they're also very hard to square with Warren's statement that she's a market-loving capitalist. So for today's Reason podcast, I'm talking with Todd Zawicki, a law professor at George Mason University and a former director of policy planning at the Federal Trade Office, among other things. A longtime critic of Warren, I'm going to talk with Zawicki about why her ideas will hurt rather than help economic growth and the fairness she professes to want. Todd Zawicki, thanks for talking to Reason.
Great to speak with you, Nick.
All right. And I will warn my listeners that I am broadcasting this or recording this from my apartment in Lower Manhattan. So there may be street noise in the background. It's just part of living in the Big Apple, at least when there's economic activity going on. Please accept my apologies proactively. But let's start with the wealth tax, Todd Zawicki. What are your thoughts about Elizabeth Warren's wealth tax?
Well, I've been around now, Senator, then Professor Warren, for a good 20 years now, going back to bankruptcy reform debates in the late 90s that eventually passed in 2005. And what I've seen over that time is sort of the development of what had kind of been an intuitive sort of embryonic political philosophy that has now emerged into, I think, sort of a more coherent worldview, of which the wealth tax is part of it. And what I think we are seeing in many ways coming from Professor Warren, whether it's the wealth tax or the public utility regulation of internet providers, as you said, or her attacks on banks over the years, sort of a modern day renaissance of the ideas of Louis Brandeis, who was one of the founders of the progressive era, and sort of really brought it to its apotheosis. And I think we see in her three fundamental ideas that are consistent with those old ideas. The first is the idea that sort of big is bad, a distrust of big economic interests, what used to be called trusts. And the idea is you either break them up and you want to have small competitors, or you regulate them as public utilities. Mm-hmm. I think the
and
second
this,
idea...
This is what Brandeis called the curse of bigness, which has shown up as the title of a book recently by Columbia law professor Tim Wu, who was the guy who codified the idea of net neutrality as well. So Brandeis is back in play, huh?
I think that's right, and it is they see it as the curse of bigness, that mm-hmm. big businesses not only distort the economy, and they do that in many ways, right? They drive out small businesses. They also, it's just assumed in some sense they exploit their workers, right? But they also are seen as having a corrupting influence on politics. Mm-hmm. That big business corrupts the political process. I think the second idea that's related to that, that comes out of the progressive era, that we see very strongly in Senator Warren, and especially you mentioned the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau that I'm sure we'll come back to, is the idea that the only way to tame these big political interests is through disinterested experts, right? That we want to have technocratic, disinterested experts in Washington who are insulated supposedly from the corrupting influences of business, right? And so they can basically promote the public interest. And that was the idea that animated, say, setting up the Interstate Commerce Commission, later the Civil Aeronautics Board, obviously came to its full fruition during the New Deal, the idea that of sort of unaccountable regulatory agencies that could set things right, right? That could be a counterweight mm-hmm. and carry out, as I said, either you want to have small competitors, or if you're going to have big companies, you want to treat them as public utilities. The third idea, I think, that you started by asking about the wealth tax is a real fear of, a visceral dislike more than anything of concentrated and inherited wealth. And I think that's a lot of what this wealth tax is really nobody thinks it's going to raise a lot of money in any serious way. But it really is. It's a symbol, right? It's a symbol of the idea that we distrust wealthy people, we distrust wealth, and in particular, the idea of sort of inherited wealth, right? That if you've mm-hmm. got a lot of wealth, then that's kind of corrupting to the public. And so I think, if you sort of start weeding through our things, we could talk about the individual things. I think we see these three sort of Brandeisian ideas: big is bad, the power of independent political, progressive regulatory agencies, and a fear of sort of concentrated inherited wealth and the class divisions that creates.
Well, let's talk about those ideas, and then we'll come back to Warren. As it happens, I recently finished Alfred Kahn's Profits of Regulation, a book that came out in the early 80s and was widely lauded for kind of laying out the goalposts of modern theories of regulation. On the one hand, there was Charles Francis Adams, who was one of the first and considered a widely successful regulator of railroads in Massachusetts and elsewhere. But what he wanted to do mostly was not set rates or get the government to make decisions, but to give the public more information. So he would publish rate schedules and things like that and kind of discuss the actual business practices of companies. And then on the other hand, there was Louis Brandeis, who was much more hands-on and a muscular regulator, kind of wanting to have somebody overseeing almost every interaction in a commercial marketplace. What do you think accounts for the fear of, the curse of bigness? Because, and we can see it partly in, the financial collapse. It's that big banks get so big, they get bailed out, right? But that isn't really what seems to be motivating Elizabeth Warren in this case.
Well, that's the interesting thing, is that this sort of, Brandeis-Warren worldview has some plausibility to it, right? Is, anybody listening to this podcast is familiar with the idea of public choice, right? Mm-hmm. And is familiar with the idea that business, and in particular, big business, can distort the political process for itself. And so there is, the fear is not unfounded. We see it with banks, right? But the problem is that what I think, and I think it's, exactly the right reference for you to mention Alfred Kahn and Kahn's historical moment, which is Kahn, of course, started the deregulatory movement under Carter, and then it accelerated under Reagan, and it led to the abolition of the Interstate Commerce Commission, which was the first progressive independent agency, led to the abolition of the Civil Aeronautics Board. Because what we learned was that sometimes we learned two things, which is first, big isn't always bad economically, and second, that the remedy can be worse than the disease. So big isn't always bad. There's a reason why Apple is so big, is because Apple sells great products that people love. And it's, you know, sometimes businesses do get big because they have political favors, but sometimes they just provide a great product and they change the world. And so one of the things we discovered was just sort of a mindless fear of sort of big business was bad for the economy, bad for economic growth, bad for consumers and everyone else. And so, and it undermined competitiveness. And so what you want to know is how did people get where they are. The second thing is that this idea of empowering these independent regulators who would be politically unaccountable didn't necessarily mean they pursued whatever they thought of as the public interest. What we saw was first, they were prone to capture by exactly the economic interest that they were supposed to regulate. And so, and sometimes that seems to have been built into their DNA. So the great economic historian Gabriel Coco, for example, who wrote that the great book, The Triumph of Conservatism, said that basically the Interstate Commerce Commission was set up by the railroads, that the railroads themselves saw that regulating rates would be a great way to keep them from competing with each other.
Coco was, just to underscore this, he was a socialist, and he did a revisionist history of the progressive era and actually made the case pretty convincingly that, in fact, you know, the progressives tell the story that the railroads fought against regulation tooth and nail, but in fact, he said they went along with it and sometimes even initiated the process because they were looking to freeze the market when they were in a good position through regulation.
Exactly. And what we've seen is again and again and again that's what happens. So the railroads, the airlines, right? Why did the airlines came to love the Civil Aeronautics Board? Because basically what it did was, you know, kept them from competing. It would set minimum routes. They would have to get everything approved. They knew what everybody was charging at every minute. And the government basically created oligopolistic rents for the railroad companies. And we've actually seen that again after the financial crisis, which is that Dodd-Frank, which is, of course, was enacted before Senator Warren was elected, but she was obviously a big sponsor. What have we learned from Dodd-Frank? Which is, number one, it did not get rid of too big to fail. Nobody believes it did. But more important, what we've seen is the legacy of Dodd-Frank after thousands of pages of legislation, tens of thousands of pages of regulation, tens of billions of dollars of compliance costs, is that the big banks are even bigger now than they've ever been. Small banks are disappearing and shrinking at twice the rate they were before Dodd-Frank. And the reason is Jamie Dimon famously once said, is Dodd-Frank created a moat around the biggest banks that protects them from competition. And why is that? The regulatory costs of complying with Dodd-Frank and any of these other regulations don't really scale with the size of the company. And so, hiring 150 new compliance lawyers at, you know, Citi is a rounding error. Hiring one more compliance lawyer at some small bank might be the difference between a profit and a loss in any given year. And so they can basically digest those costs in an easier way. And that creates gravity towards concentration in the banking industry. And of course, now the big banks are even more intertwined with the political process than they ever had. And I think that was Kahn's lesson, right? Kahn's lesson was first, you know, that focusing on sort of just destroying big businesses simply because they're big can end up hurting economic growth if you're getting rid of good companies. And the second is this idea that over time, the economic interests, they don't just go away, right? They end up if you kind of put them in the hands of these unaccountable bureaucrats, they end up capturing, was the term, capturing those agencies and end up being run for themselves.
Yeah, and it's got to be, I would think that it would give people pause that last year there were a number of hearings on at the Senate and at the House of tech giants and representatives or the CEOs of places like Google, like Facebook, like Twitter came and, you know, and they said point blank, you know, we're ready to be regulated and we want to help you to write the regulations. And we need to because we're the ones who know the business. I mean, it was plain from the way most congressmen and senators talked about these businesses. They had no idea. And earlier this year, Tim Cook, not surprisingly, in the, you know, it was around the week when Apple was briefly not the biggest company, a corporation on the face of the planet, said that, you know, the markets aren't working right anymore and that high tech needs to be regulated. Is that is just a flat out playing out of what Gabriel Coco or Alfred Kahn would say, right? This is regulatory capture. It's kind of public choice economics 101.
It really is public choice economics 101. And what it ends up doing, they're the ones who, if they can write the rules, essentially, they negotiate them. They're the ones who have the deep pockets to hire the lawyers and lobbyists and that sort of thing to kind of manipulate the process. And so who gets shut out? It's always been the entrepreneurs. It's always been the small companies who face these huge regulatory barriers and lack the, lack the connectedness and the lobbyists and everybody else to be able to manipulate the system in the way that the big businesses can. It really is public choice 101, as you say.
Warren, let's talk a little bit about the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, because that's really when she kind of burst onto a national stage in a big way. And you were an early and prolific critic of that. What did it seek to do, and why were you against that?
Well, I was actually for the idea of a modernized sort of modernized consumer financial protection approach, mm-hmm. Sort of putting it all under one roof. I would have probably just given it to the Federal Trade Commission, but the system we had did not work very well based on my experience at the Federal Trade Commission. It was all distributed among different places. And what I really disagree with is the way in which the agency was structured and the more sort of ideological approach to it. So the big thing is that it was structured specifically as a consumer protection agency. And for the first, 8 years or whatever, it sort of played out that way, which obviously consumer protection is great. But also the problem though is consumers also benefit from innovation and choice and competition and lower prices. And what we essentially saw was an ideology arise that basically said, consumers are always victims. And we have to, reduce access to products, like when they banned payday loans. But beyond that, what we saw was the other part was we talked about big business capturing agencies, but we also saw was the bureaucrats themselves can capture agencies, right? Which is that when they're unaccountable, basically what you get is whatever the idiosyncrasies are of the particular agency and the people who work here, it takes on that flavor, right? And the CFPB, there's been a lot of studies on this, became a very activist agency. And they brought sort of a mindset, and it is a very Warrenite mindset, that banks and consumers are basically locked in a zero-sum game, and that anything that's good for banks is bad for consumers and vice versa, rather than thinking really about how do we create regulations that will promote competition, consumer choice, innovation in a level playing field. I think the main thing I disagreed with, though, was the structure. And again, this goes back to it was sort of the ultimate Brandeisian agency, in that the way the CFPB was structured, it has a single director who is nominated and confirmed for a 5-year term, can be removed only for cause, and the budget of the agency is appropriated directly by the Federal Reserve. Hmm. It's basically said it's 12% of the revenues of the Federal Reserve, which last year I think was $597 million. And to give you a sense of how much that is, that's twice the budget of the Federal Trade Commission. which is the other major consumer protection agency at the federal level, in addition to doing antitrust. But this idea of having a single director completely insulated from any political oversight, right? 5-year term, Congress cannot control the budget. There are various other things that were done with that, is this ultimate view, right? Is that her view was that, ironically, that one of the causes of the financial crisis was that the regulators were too accountable in some sense, that Congress interfered, and that was certainly the case with Fannie and Freddie, right, which is the political footsie they played with Congress, helped them create the trouble that they created. But the idea would be to basically strip out all accountability in the way the accountability of the president and the way that an executive department does, and accountability the way a traditional independent agency was, which is a beyond budget and would have a bipartisan board. Here what you had was one person, no budgetary control, and that was the idea. And unfortunately, the agency ended up developing exactly as I had predicted, which is that basically the bureaucrats captured the agency, and they were by no means resistant to all interest groups, as, for example, their rulemaking barring arbitration in consumer finance contracts, which had been sought by trial lawyers for a very long time and was a very poorly reasoned rule that Congress eventually got rid of. And so I think that some degree of political accountability is a good thing. But it falls out of this ideological framework that less accountability is better because all accountability is corrupting.
How is the CFPB faring under Donald Trump's presidency? Has he placed his own director, or is it still an overhang situation where it's an Obama appointee?
Richard Cordray was the director, as you mentioned in your introduction, Nick. Everybody thought Warren was going to run the agency. She ended up, for various reasons, not getting it. And instead, they appointed Richard Cordray, the former attorney general of Ohio, who Warren had actually hired as the enforcement director for the agency. And he ended up, there were sort of two candidates, Cordray and one other person. The other person was seen as sort of more of a moderate. Cordray was seen sort of more of, an aggressive person, sort of, modern day progressive, was going to go after the bad guys. And he hung over till about 2017. And then he resigned to run for governor of Ohio, which he lost. Mick Mulvaney then was appointed the acting director. And finally, this past December this past year, 2018, a permanent successor was confirmed, a woman named Kathy Kraninger, who's very much an unknown. And at this point, it hasn't really done much, and it's not quite clear what's going to happen. I think the jury's still out. She has really no record on these issues and hasn't really done much to this point to judge sort of how it's going to play out.
And I guess that's part of, the design error then, that, essentially, depending on who gets to pick the director, the agency is either going to be vibrant or not or whatever, which creates, if nothing else, some unpredictability over time.
Right, exactly. I mean, you could very easily see these huge pendulum swings where you have one person for 5 years. You can even imagine a situation where a president was tied to a director of the opposite party for his entire term. Mm-hmm. I think in the end, the Supreme Court is going to end up holding it unconstitutional. There are a number of cases bumping around that are making their way towards the Supreme Court. I think that they finally passed the Rubicon of something that's so unaccountable that it's unconstitutional. Hmm. But that's by no means clear. And if this agency structure is constitutional, then there really is no limit on what Congress could do to sort of eliminate accountability from an agency. This is as far as it goes. Is the D.C. Circuit said, Brett Kavanaugh at the time of the D.C. Circuit said, this is the second most powerful person in the government, basically, in light of how much power they have without accountability is in the hands of a single person.
You mentioned that Elizabeth Warren seems to conceive of all kind of interactions in the marketplace to be zero sum, and that it's almost always that a big corporation can just run roughshod over regular consumers. Part of her rhetoric around the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau was that all contracts essentially should be distilled down and should be simple enough that they could fit on two pages. This was a big talking point. That is, you know, beyond paternalistic on a certain level. It's saying that, like, a lot of us can't understand what we're doing. Having said that, it's also true that a lot of us get into trouble because we, you know, and I you know, we say, oh, yeah, I understand. You've shown me. And I guess this is partly banks do this because they, you know, they don't ultimately, they don't make money by underwriting loans that don't get paid back. But, you know, we know what the interest rate is. We know what the overall amount of money we're going to spend over the term of a loan or whatever. But people do blow it all the time. What is there anything that government can do about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, as I said, I actually agreed with the idea of sort of a more coherent, modern regulatory framework at the federal level. I mean, a lot of consumer credit products now are national. For example, you know, one of the examples I give is the closest competitor to payday loans is bank overdraft protection. If you look at how consumers use the product, yet bank overdraft protection is regulated by the federal government through the Office of Comptroller Currency and the Federal Reserve and the FDIC through a safety and soundness sort of supervision regime. Payday loans have been regulated at the state level through an enforcement regime by state AGs, or a regulatory system that recognizes that those products compete with each other and that they compete in interstate markets. I think would be a really useful thing, and I've thought a lot about and written about that a lot, about what that that should look like. The increasing, you know, the complexity of the world, for want of a better word, is also a real thing, right? Whether it's computers or cars or, you know, I remember my dad used to fix his own car, and almost nobody can fix their own car now, right? Because you got to hook it up to the computers and that sort of thing. But that complexity actually makes sense, right? And it's the same way with financial products, which is a lot of the complexity makes sense. People use financial products in very complex ways to accomplish their own goals. At the same time, sometimes people get confused, and there's absolutely a role, I think, for regulation to prevent fraud and deception and those sorts of things. And I think an argument could be made for those things. I think where Senator Warren goes awry, and again, I think we can see early forerunners of this in history, which is, you know, coming out of the Great Depression and coming out of the panics of the late 19th century, especially in the Midwest, in sort of those farmer areas where she was from, this is where there's always been this sort of prairie distrust of banks, right? The idea that banks are just out to get you. And, you know, there was a lot of criticisms in the, so Henry Ford, who, you know, was a great manufacturer, but also a notorious anti-Semite in his day, for example, he refused to allow Ford to loan money to people for cars. When the General Motors Acceptance Corporation came along and allowed people to borrow money to buy a car, Henry Ford basically responded by saying you could buy a car on layaway. send them a check every month for 10 years and they'd give you a car. Why wouldn't he give it on credit? Because Henry Ford basically thought, well, consumer credit was just the way that they get you, right? And he attributed it to sort of an anti, that there was Jewish bankers.
He's the one who published the Protocols of the Elders of Zion and the Dearborn Independent, the newspaper for the company town he created. I assume he's rolling over in his grave now that Dearborn is one of two Muslim majority cities in America.
That's right.
And has, you know, like more Little League teams than most towns per capita. So he must be very confused.
He was tapping into a distrust of banks and a distrust of bankers and a distrust of consumer credit, right? It wasn't all anti-Semitic, but it was a historical epoch. And so that's always been a strain, a strain in American history, is the idea that the banks are taking advantage of people, ripping them off, cheating them, that sort of thing. And so this is a long rhetorical trope in American history that I think she is, you know, sort of consciously or unconsciously sort of, you know, she's a product of that if you read her own writings, she's kind of a product of that distrust of banks from sort of Oklahoma in the era she grew up.
There's, I'm thinking of the Pete Seeger song Pretty Boy Floyd about, a murderous gangster in the Depression era. And he is compared favorably to bankers because he gives poor people turkeys that he stole on Thanksgiving. But, you know, the bankers steal your house with a pen, you know, et cetera.
Right.
So,
right.
But, you know, in that kind of context, isn't there something, you know, coming out of the financial crisis where, you know, big banks did a lot of really bad stuff and they didn't do any kind of diligence. They didn't do any kind of, what they were supposed to be doing in underwriting mortgages. And then they come out kind of smelling like a rose. I mean, it isn't surprising, is it, that, you know, when Warren and other people like her, and including there's some of this in Donald Trump, when they talk about the system is rigged and that the people who are connected get all of the goodies and then they get off scot-free. I mean, there's something there, isn't there?
Absolutely, yes. And, John Lott has this, you know, this article that the title says it all, right, which is why our campaign contributions going up because the government is so big, right? And I think absolutely they have a point, right? Which is that concentrated interests do capture the government. Concentrated interests do influence politics.
How do you dismantle that? I mean, because, you know, Warren has that Brandeisian, you know, tradition, which is that you create these commissions of very smart people who will be disinterested, who somehow will avoid regulatory capture or, you know, agency capture. That doesn't work. And then what is the alternative that is a plausible, a different way of doing things?
Yeah, and that's that's exactly the point, right? Which is they have this faith that it can work, right? And so you either have small businesses, right? So you use antitrust laws very aggressively, and you otherwise use rate regulation, right? And mm-hmm. treat them as public utilities. So, for example, Warren's approach to consumer credit is, if you're familiar, she wants to have the post office get in the banking system, mm-hmm. right? Because she basically sees, competition as competition to take advantage of consumers. So we'll have the post office make small dollar loans and that sort of thing. And their view at this point is that basically Woodrow Wilson was a wimp. Mm-hmm. That Wilson wanted to have a progressive state with these independent agencies. But the problem was he didn't go all the way. He was half-hearted. He needs to go to complete unaccountability of the type that we have at the CFPB, right? That he left too much room for the interest groups, right? And so what they believe is you can have big government, number one, but more important than you can have big discretionary government, right, that is not mm-hmm. bound by the rule of law in the sense that Hayek did, Hayek spoke of, and that somehow or another big discretionary government will not end up getting corrupted by the people that it regulates, right? I think that that's a very naive view of politics and a very naive view of the regulatory process. But that's basically where I think she comes down, is more power to regulators with less accountability. And that they should be in the business of determining what's fair and who should win and who should lose. And somehow or another, this is going to come out to help the public.
Let's talk a little bit about the curse of bigness, because you had mentioned Apple earlier, you know, which is obviously a hugely successful company. And on another level, it's not exactly clear what Apple is the dominant force in. Right. Because like worldwide, globally, they don't, Samsung and other companies sell more phones than they do. Right. They have, you know, in terms of computers running on a particular operating system, Android and, Windows and a bunch of other places have far more. Is Apple a company that is, you know, it's gigantic. It's the biggest company in the world, essentially. But does it undermine her case that bigness always comes at the cost of competition in a market?
Yeah, and that's the thing, right? Which is, it's always been the case, is that worldview tends to look at a static rather than a dynamic approach to competition, right? So you've probably, you know, gotten a chuckle from these articles that sometimes go around Facebook from, you know, Wired Magazine or someplace like that from 10 years ago that says, is anyone going to do something about the MySpace monopoly, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, whether it was the big three automakers who had to be regulated and then basically, you know, came into competition, or whether it
was... So then they get regulated, then they get bailed out after they can't hack it in global competition.
That's right. Yeah, and whether it was Microsoft and, you know, their Internet Explorer browser, which by the time that case was resolved had already been passed by, if I'm not mistaken, had already been passed by Chrome and market share, various different things, right? Which is, at any given time, you can look at these markets, you can be afraid, right? Mm-hmm. But what we've seen is this dynamic and so, you know, what the alternative view has always been, which I would say is probably the Alfred Kahn view that you were talking about earlier, is, well, what we really didn't know is how did this company get big, and is there any barriers to entry to keep somebody from competing with them? So mm-hmm. one of the things I think is very funny, you know, sort of interesting, is we were concerned about Walmart, right? And then mm-hmm. Amazon came and put a lot of competitive pressure on Walmart. And who is Amazon probably most afraid of in the online retail space now? Probably Walmart, right?
So there's a
dynamism there.
Yeah, and let's talk about, you know, when we talk about retail, it's for me, the idea of regulating a platform utility, or, you know, say something like, so, you know, on an iPhone, there's place you can, the App Store, where you can go and Apple gets to approve everything that goes on there, and then they sell their own stuff. And we want, Warren wants to stop that, but is that in any way different, or how is it different than when you go into a Kroger supermarket, or, you know, a Harris Teeter or a Vons, whatever supermarket chain, where, you know, they sell generic versions of all of the same of brand name goods. Should we say to grocery stores that you can't sell Kroger brand peas, like generic peas, because you should only be able to sell Del Monte and Green Giant, et cetera? I mean, what is the fear that, you know, that the company that's providing the marketplace is going to cheat other customers? Do you have a clear sense of what the issue is there?
I think that there's, you know, they've got this inchoate fear that somehow or another they're going to take advantage of, you know, their suppliers, whatever that looks like, right? But a lot of times, I mean, who are these suppliers? So Johnson & Johnson, right? Mm-hmm. It's Kellogg, it's, you know, all these different sorts of companies. And so, you know, I think that what they just, it really is this, I think, just sort of nagging fear that big is bad, that somehow or another, if you have some sort of economic power, you are going to misuse it. My colleague, Tim Muris, wrote a great article, George Mesa colleague, looking at A&P and the rise of the A&P grocery store chain, and the comparisons to how how destructive A&P would be for the economy to Amazon today, right? And how they would run these, you know, small grocery stores out of business and that sort of thing. And it's just gotten an interesting parallel, and it touches on a lot of those same sorts of things, which is that they would be this gateway, they would control what gets sold, they would drive out small competitors who are less efficient, all those sorts of things. And so I don't really get a sense that there's a tangible harm that they point to. There's just an unease that comes with sort of anything that's new and big, is as far as I can tell, is about what it is.
Yeah, it seems that there's also, I mean, I've seen in Warren's writing and elsewhere a gesture towards innovation that gets stymied when an industry sector is so dominated that, you know, the tech giant in that area buys up, an app company, or buys up something that might be a competitor, so that you see Google buying up certain types of things, Amazon buying up certain types of things, Facebook, et cetera, and incorporating them into their own system. But that's, you know, it seems, you know, it's not clear what we miss in that. And then there are the companies, you know, something like Twitter, where it's, you know, it's desperately trying to figure out how to actually create an IPO now that it's losing daily users, you know, and also, right, that's one of the companies that said, yeah, we're ready to be regulated, which is kind of fascinating. And to then to claim that somebody has a monopoly on a system that, you know, on a service that didn't really exist 15 years ago is, it gets dicey pretty quickly. But it is also, you know, there's sympathy there for the idea that the world is kind of out of control, or that things, you know, forces larger than yourself are dictating ultimately whether, you know, you flourish or you famish. And I guess this goes back to that prairie populism. How did we turn that corner? Would it have been in the 70s and 80s when deregulation started and people became more optimistic? I mean, is this part like a kind of animal spirits argument that, you know, we need to have faith that if we loosen up on regulation, that new and better things will happen? Or, you know, how do we sell the counterpoint to an Elizabeth Warren presidency?
It's a great question, Nick, and one I've thought about a lot, because what was fascinating, right, was that you know, what basically shook up the system in the 70s in the United States was the end of, you know, sort of the American economic post-World War global economic hegemony, right? And we saw competition from Japan in cars, and we saw, you know, just declining, competitiveness everywhere, and a lot of it had to do with the Interstate Commerce Commission, which regulated trucking, mm-hmm. And so drove up the cost of transportation of goods by rail and truck. We had the Civil Aeronautics Board, which basically had planes flying half empty because they were keeping fares so high, right? And the other thing that was kind of interesting, it was sort of bad economics, but politically fortuitous, was a concern about inflation. Right. And so one of the things that they were concerned about was, what are these increasing transportation costs doing to drive up prices? Right. Because, you know, inflation was, you know, 6% or something like that during Nixon. But you kind of put that situation together with really the power of ideas, which can't be understated, and, you know, the power of Alfred Kahn and his ideas. And again, you know, what we saw during the 70s was a bipartisan support for regulatory reform. And a lot of it was the Democrats of that era came to appreciate this idea of capture theory, that the regulatory agencies have been captured by the interests they were supposed to regulate. And so a lot of people don't remember this, but of all people, the one who spearheaded deregulation in Congress was Ted Kennedy.
Right. Yeah. And he was helped along by Ralph Nader. And Alfred Kahn, of course, was a Democrat himself.
Exactly. And Stephen Breyer was mm-hmm. now Supreme Court Justice. Stephen Breyer was chief counsel for Kennedy. Right. And they pushed and they said, basically, this bad regulation is driving up prices and reducing consumer choice for consumers and hurting consumers. And that came along with Reagan. And one of the fascinating things to me is that, that bipartisan consensus broke apart. And an interesting story was told to me by our mutual friend Susan Dudley, who ran the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs at during the Bush administration. She and her husband met with Kahn right before his death. And she asked him that question. And Kahn said, "It broke my heart when Ralph Nader turned against deregulation. So why did he do it?" And basically what it came down to was, deregulation made markets more competitive, and what markets do is competition gets rid of what economists call economic rents, right? Essentially monopoly profits. Now, why does that matter? Because labor unions actually don't increase market, can't increase the equilibrium price of labor. What they can do, however, is bargain over economic rents in an economic sense, right? So whether it's railroads or airlines or whatever, and inadvertently, by making markets more competitive, they got rid of these pools of economic rents and ended up weakening the labor movement. And essentially what ended up happening, according to Kahn, was Ralph Nader basically decided, I care more about the labor unions than I care about the consumers. And so at that point then, they basically turned against deregulation and its impact, as it's, you know, if we see in the airlines, for example, as it swept across the industry, wages fell, mm-hmm. Even as prices fell in, you know, convenience rose. And so I think now we're kind of reached that point where, you know, that was a brief window in time that I think may be hard to replicate.
Yeah, especially given that a number of Republicans are, when we talk about the tech sector and particularly social media companies, are going hammer at tongs at services like Facebook or YouTube, which is owned by Google, for not, you know, supposedly suppressing the popularity of conservative viewpoints. So they're, you know, if anything, we seem to be going in the other direction now, where Republicans and Democrats are talking about colluding to strip the tech giants of, you know, of certain amounts of market autonomy in the name of either fairness or goodness or something.
That's a brilliant point, Nick. And I think that's the other part of it, right? Which is that politicians now, I think, have become in a bipartisan way much more savvy about knowing how to shake down these companies, right? What Fred McChesney called rent extraction, where you basically go to the companies, whether they're hedge funds or Facebook or whoever, and basically say, you know, we're thinking about regulating you unless you can persuade us otherwise, right? And so one of the things we see now that we did not see in the 70s when we got deregulation, and remember at the time, Mansur Olson wrote his famous book, The Rise and Decline of Nations, where he mm-hmm. basically said that interest groups and the entanglement between interest groups and regulators would basically stymie economic growth. We managed to crack through that and got, you know, two decades of you know, the greatest growth in American history, pretty much. But now there's a way in which the regulators are much more entrenched. If you look at the banking industry for now, the regulation, the tentacles are so intertwined, right? Which is, you know, the bank, yeah, basically the deal is now, you know, the implicit deal is we're going to bail out the big banks. You know, we gave them, you know, $750 billion. And in exchange, the politicians are going to kind of use them as their off-balance sheet sort of device to get, you know, accomplish their own goals, which we really saw in the CFPB during the Obama years, but is more general now. And so, you know, it's this sort of unseemly alliance between where the politicians get something out of it now, and like you're saying, is the politicians get direct or indirect economic, you know, political benefits from beating up on these guys.
Well, we're going to leave it there. We've been talking with Todd Zawicki. He's a law professor at George Mason University, and he's the former head of policy planning at the Financial Trade Commission. Todd, thanks so much for talking to Reason.
Thank you, Nick.
Please, if you enjoyed this, please subscribe to us at Apple, at Google, at Spotify, at Reason.com. There are basically any place you get your podcasts on. Please do that. And thanks for listening.